In Judges 6, then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. Again they fell into sin. Again God delivered them into the hands of an oppressing nation. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of Midian, the sons of Israel made for themselves the dens which were in the mountains, and the caves and the strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. So they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. The Midianites, instead of just occupying the country, basically had annual raids for plunder and destruction and slaughter. The Israelites were forced into sort of a primitive existence in caves and the inaccessible mountain regions. And the Midianites, just whenever they wanted to, came in, plopped all over the country and stole all the crops. They used all these camels that were innumerable. They, along with the sons of East, were like locusts in number. And the text says that they brought Israel very low. The intensity of the punishment continues to ramp up as their wickedness continues to go down. Now in verse 7, it came about when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord on account of Midian, that the Lord sent a prophet to the sons of Israel. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, it was I who brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of from the house of slavery. I delivered you from the hands of the Egyptians and from the hands of all your oppressors and dispossessed them before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not obeyed me." They sought God's help in agony, but more concerned about their oppression than regret over their evil deeds. And at this time, instead of sending them a deliverer, God sent them a prophet to pinpoint the problem that was leading to these periods of oppression. It was more important right here that they understood the reason for their predicament than that they were eliminating it. God gave them what they needed, not necessarily what they wanted, because the real problem is idolatry, not Midianite camels. They really need to deal with what the issue is in their lives. So often, our focus, when we get in trouble because we haven't done what God wanted us to do, is on what can we do to resolve the difficulty. But the real thing we need to do is resolve the sin that led to the difficulty. We almost have this victim mentality. Poor me! Look what happened to me! Well, the issue is not so much what happened to me as what I did to the Lord. So God does not act like some robot just responding to their cry. He tells them, you know, what the problem was, and just kind of leaves them hanging. I wonder about us. When we reap the painful consequences of our sins, do we want God to give us a quick fix? Or do we want to truly deal with the underlying sin that caused the problem? That's a good thing for us to reflect on. So, in verse 11, then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press in order to save it from the Midianites. Now, do you get that visual? The Midianites are coming in and stealing the crops. He's threshing the wheat in a little wine press, not in a typical threshing floor, hoping that by doing just a really small quantity, that maybe the Midianites won't find it, and And it kind of shows you their desperation as they were trying to hide what little bit of crops the Midianites hadn't destroyed. And the angel comes to Gideon. The angel of the Lord appeared to him, verse 12, and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." And Gideon said to him, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." He's like, it doesn't look to me like God's with us. If he was, why are all these terrible things happening? It's almost like Gideon here represents the nation in blaming God for the problem instead of understanding their responsibility for it. Well, verse 14, the Lord looked at him and said, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" He said to him, "O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house." But the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man." Gideon's like, how in the world am I going to do this? You know, God can't really use you until you recognize your inadequacy and your need for him. When we see our weakness, then God can begin to work with us. When we rely on our own strength, how could God ever do anything through us? We credit ourselves instead of the Lord anyway, right? So God said, "I'll be with you, and you'll win as easily as if you were slaying one man." That's God's commitment to him. God's presence will always empower us for the tasks he calls us to do. You remember when Jesus told the disciples, "You feed them"? And he was talking about 5,000 men. They didn't understand how in the world they could do that. God said, "What you got?" Jesus said, "What you got?" "Well, I got 5 sandwiches. He said, "Get the men to sit down." And he started passing out the sandwiches. He just kept passing them out. You know, the fact is, when God says to do something, he will give us the means to accomplish it. We just need to do it. So Gideon talks to him in verses 17 to 24. And, you know, he offers to feed him. And Gideon goes and is allowed to bring an offering. And the angel actually goes up in the fire of the offering. That was kind of wild. And then in verse 25, on the same night, the Lord said to him, "Take your father's bull and a second bull 7 years old and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of this stronghold in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you shall cut down." And then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him, and because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night. Now, the first thing God wants Gideon to do, he's going to use Gideon to deliver them from the Midianites, but first things first, he's got to remove the cause. In his father's household, this altar to Baal. God is showing again what the real problem was. The people are not true to the Lord. And so he says, "I want you to tear down the altar to Baal in your father's household and build an altar to the Lord. And take the Asherah and use them for the firewood." Well, Gideon does it, although he does it at night, and he's got some bodyguards to help him. He's afraid of what the reaction will be. These are supposed to be the people of God, but they're not going to take kindly to Gideon opposing Baal worship. And you know, there are other times in the Bible where God has asked servants of his to deal with sin in their own lives and the lives of their family before they could be used in the service of God. Remember Moses? Remember, God sends him back to Egypt. On the way, God tried to kill him because he hadn't circumcised his sons like God had said. And he gets his wife, Zipporah, asked to do that to, you know, keep Moses alive. God wants us to be committed to him. He wants us to be committed to him above anything else, even the wishes of our family or our fellow countrymen. God's will comes first. So 28, when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down. And the Asherah which was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built. They said to one another, "Who did this thing?" And when they searched about and inquired, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, did this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son, that he may die. For he's torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah which was beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar." Therefore, on that day he named him Jerubbaal, that is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he'd torn down his altar. Now, isn't that an incredible reaction to destroying the idol altar? The townspeople were outraged. And they wanted to stone Gideon. But you remember in the law, stoning was supposed to be the punishment for idol worship. They have made Baal the official religion and are opposing anybody who opposes that. Heresy has become the dominant idea. And the Lord's still willing to deliver them. It's amazing to me that the Lord is willing to take a people like this and deliver them. And Gideon's father intervenes and he says, "Well, look, if Baal's really God, then he should be able to take care of himself and fight his own battles." And that kind of backs off the townspeople, and there they are. Gideon has successfully torn down the Baal altar, at least. That is his family's contribution to the false religion. So verse 33, "Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves, and they crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and the Abiezerites were called together to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh. They also were called together to follow him, and he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, and they came to meet him. Then Gideon said to God, 'If you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there's dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken.' And it was so. When he arose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water." Now, that's interesting. God delights to strengthen fragile faith. Sometimes we try to impress God when we need help from God. And the thing of it is, we can never hide anything from God anyway. We might as well turn to God openly with our weaknesses. Gideon says, I need some reassurance here. If you're really going to do this, can you give me a sign to prove it? I just need you. I'm going to put this fleece on the ground, and you make the fleece wet and the ground around it dry, and that'll be all I'll need. Well, rings forth a bowl full of water out of that fleece. When the Lord does a miracle, he does it upright. And the funny thing is, Gideon kind of goes back on what he said, because he says, "Do not let your anger burn against me, that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground." God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, and dew was on all the ground. So God was amazingly patient with Gideon. God gave him reassurance to strengthen his faith. When your faith is weak, tell the Lord and ask for encouragement and strength. It may not be with a fleece, but God will help us strengthen our faith when we're willing to turn to him for that. So, chapter 7, verse 1, "Then Jerubbaal," that is Gideon, remember his other name, "and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon," this is amazing, "the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. For Israel will become boastful, saying, My own power has delivered me.'" Now God raised the opposite problem I would have. There's only 32,000 Israelite soldiers. And by putting everything together in the text, it looks to me like there's 135,000 enemy soldiers. They're outnumbered 4-1. I'd say there wasn't the right number of soldiers either, but I would have said there were too little. He said, "You got too many." And here's the reason. If they're outnumbered 4-1 and they win, they're going to think they've done it. And it's really kind of hard to imagine how you could think that. When you're outnumbered 4-1 and you think, "You did it?" But I guess you'd be even prouder thinking you overcome such great odds and won. Man has this terrible tendency not to see the hand of God and not to give God the credit for what he's done. You remember that? This is a good illustration of that, I think. You remember that amazing incident with Jacob? Now, Jacob did that all the time. You know, he was always trying to connive his way himself into the blessings God was giving him. But you remember that one time when he makes this deal with Laban about those rods? You know, he made the deal that, you know, he'd take the striped, speckled, spotted, multicolored, you know, animals. And Laban thought that was a great deal. And he, you know, segregated all the ones that were already that way. So Jacob just started with pure color animals. So the gene pool's not too good about this. And you remember what Jacob does. He makes these striped branches. You know how the bark is a little darker than the inside, so he cuts that, notches out the bark and puts it in front of the animals when they're mating. That way, when the animals are mating, they're looking at this striped branch. Because like everybody knows that what you're looking at when you're mating, that's what the offspring will come out like, right? You know, it's clear that genetics was not well understood, at least by Jacob. But they came out that way. That's exactly what happened. Now, the jokes on Jacob had nothing to do with those rods. You know, it reminds me, I saw this on YouTube later. I didn't see the actual Super Bowl game. This has probably been 5 years ago. On the Super Bowl, one of the ads they told about, I don't even know what it was advertising, but it was this like 7-year-old with a Darth Vader wand that he was going around zapping stuff. And he goes up to this car in the garage or whatever, and he zaps the car with his wand, but he doesn't know it. His dad's behind him with the remote. And when he does that with the wand, the car starts up and it spooks him. He like thought he did it. We're like that so much. We think we did it. Instead of the Lord, that's what God's worried about right here. And so, verse 3, now therefore, come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. Look, get a load of this. So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. God says, tell all the ones who are afraid to go back home, apparently excluding Gideon himself. And over two-thirds left. When given the chance, they melt away. It's kind of a terrible discovery to find out more than two-thirds of the army was ready to go home as soon as they were given a chance because they were too scared. Now he's outnumbered 13.5-1. Wow, that's going to be pretty tough. The Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you. But every one of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, you shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. Now the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people kneeled to drink water. The Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and will give the Midianites into your hands, so let all the other people go, each man to his own home. So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands, and Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men. The camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now, just think about it. God says, they're going to think they did it, even outnumbered 13.5-1. Isn't that an incredible tendency to pride? You know, can you imagine thinking we did it, outnumbered 13.5-1? But that is so much man's tendency to take credit for himself. So God says, I want you to take them down to the brook, and I want you to watch how they drink. Now, there is a debate about what this means. I'm going to give you my take. You don't have to agree with it. But it looks to me like that God is not trying to choose the best men. That wouldn't fit the context to me. He's trying to choose the men that will most demonstrate that he's the one who's got the brains and the brawn behind all of this. So it looks to me like he brings them down to the brook, And most of the men, like any self-respecting man would do when he's told to drink from the water, just sticks his head under there and drinks it. But there are a few men who really don't want to get their head down under there. So they cup their hands and they kind of bring it up and kind of lap the water out of their hands. You know, kind of over-mothered men that were a little too squeamish about putting their head under there. And those were the 300 that he chooses. You know, because it really doesn't matter to the Lord how competent they are or how courageous they are or how manly they are when it's the Lord, the one who's going to do the battling. So if you think, well, what was it about those 300 that made them better soldiers? I think we're asking the wrong question. I think he chose the 300 least likely. You think about, why didn't God choose a mighty warrior to kill Goliath? Why did he choose a shepherd boy? You know, why did God have Elijah douse the sacrifice with 12 big buckets of water before he spontaneously ignited it? I mean, in all of those things, it seems to me that the point is to show that God's the one who has the power. It's not us. So, now, 300 wimpy men against 135,000 of the Midianites. Now, Gideon needed a bit more encouragement, so in 9-15, he gets another shot in the arm by overhearing some things he was eavesdropping in the Midianite camp. And then in verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. He said to them, look at me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. Never did an army advance with such a strange assortment of weapons. You know, trumpet, torch, and pitcher. They don't provide you with that equipment in the Army, the Navy, or the Marines. And never has there been such a strange assortment of military skills. These aren't things they train you for at West Point. Blowing the trumpet, breaking the jar, and shouting. That's really going to do a lot of good, right? Well, anything works when God's the one doing it. You just obey him, whatever he tells you to do, and that'll work. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. When they had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers that were in their hands, when the three companies, they're on three sides of the Midianite camp, blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing and cried, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying out as they fled. When they blew 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army. The army fled as far as Bethshitta towards Zerahemla and so forth, and the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. Wow. It's kind of ironic. They shout, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, but the actual swords are the Midianite swords. They're the ones who have the swords, and they're awakened from their sleep in the dark. They're aggressive. They immediately go on the attack, but they kill each other. More or less, the Israelite army is irrelevant. And Gideon then, in verse 24, sends messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. They captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb, while they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. So Gideon, now that he's got the army on the run, summons the Ephraimites to station themselves at the fords of the Jordan so that the Midianites can't cross back over, and they manage to kill these two leaders, Oreb and Zeeb. But that meant that Gideon had not called upon the Ephraimites at the beginning of the battle. He calls upon them kind of near the end here when they're fleeing already. So look at 8:1. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Ebiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Now, do you get the point? They're frustrated. The Ephraimites are. "You didn't call us earlier." Now, Gideon has done what God told him to do. Gideon has taken his life in his own hands to go and fight against the Midianites, and now the Ephraimites are beefing because they weren't asked earlier. What would you have said if you'd been Gideon? You know, how frustrated would you have been? Gideon kept his emotions under control and spoke wisely. He said, "Why, you guys did more than me." He said, "Why, the best wine that my country can produce is less than the scraps that come from you. I mean, the gleanings from you guys is better than the whole harvest in my country. You've done a lot more than I. You conquered the two leaders." A soft answer turns away wrath. Proverbs 15:1. That's exactly what he showed. He was calm. He was able to silence the criticism of resentment by showing respect for what they had done. You remember this incident. A couple nights from now, this will come back in a different format, and we'll see what would have happened if he had had a different attitude. But I want you to see the lesson in this story. What God can do with 300 poorly equipped, over-mothered men. Do you remember that time in 2 Kings chapter 6? When the Arameans have surrounded the city where Elisha and his servant are. And his servant said, "What are we going to do?" And Elisha said, "Open his eyes, Lord." And God opened the servant's eyes to see the hills filled with God's horses and chariots. If we could only see what the Lord has in his hand, if we could only see the Lord's army, if we could only see the Lord's strength, we become panic-stricken and alarmed because what are we going to do? Look at all these things, bad things, horrible things. I don't know what we're going to do about this. Trust the Lord. Do whatever he tells us to do. He has the victory well in hand. He has plenty of forces. We may think there's not very many of us, and we're not very capable. He doesn't need many, and he doesn't need capability. He's got all of that. He just wants us to contribute to his purpose by fulfilling what he says, and he will give us the victory. That's really the lesson of those 300 men. It doesn't take more than 300 men. The truth is, it doesn't take any men. Look at 2 Chronicles 20 if you want to see a story about that, where nobody went to the battle and God still won the victory and wiped out the enemies. He can do that by himself with nobody if that's what it takes. But we need to be one of those men, one of the men that's willing to just submit to the Lord and serve him, give ourselves to him, and be what he wants us to be. And if you're not that, you need to come and obey the gospel tonight. And let the Lord make you one of his servants, one of his soldiers, willing to follow his will, trusting in him that he will give the victory. If you need to obey the gospel, won't you come when we stand and sing?